This episode of the Real Fit Podcast is brought to you by the Real Nourished newsletter. Real Nourished, reinventing your relationship with food, is for you if you are ready to stop micromanaging your food and exercise so you can start fully showing up to your life. Each biweekly issue features evidence-based tools that will help reduce your food-related anxiety, improve your body image, and help you embrace exercise as a form of nourishment, not punishment. When you subscribe, you'll get my free guide, 11 things you can do right now to feel better about your body. To get in on it, just click on the link in the show notes or visit my website, pam-more.com.
I had just been riding a energy roller coaster prior to that. If you do a hard workout and then wait until you feel hungry again to actually eat, like it's just a constant cycle of like crashing and then eating a ton of food. Yeah. And then working out again.
Welcome to the Real Fit Podcast, featuring conversations with women athletes about body image, confidence, enoughness, and so much more. I'm your host, Pam Moore. I'm an occupational therapist turned freelance journalist. I'm also a 2-time Ironman finisher, a 6-time marathoner, a mom of 2, and an intuitive eating coach. I'm super excited to share today's episode with you. Before we dive in, I have a quick request. If you have been enjoying this podcast, or if you end up enjoying this particular episode, it would mean so much to me if you haven't already, if you would subscribe to this podcast or follow it, rate it and review it. That helps other people find it, helps me spread that message that you're already enough. With no further ado, let's do this thing. I am so excited to introduce today's guest, Sarah Gross, the CEO and founder of Feisty Media. After defending her PhD in women's history in 2008, Sarah competed as a professional triathlete for 14 years and won 2 Ironman titles and 2 major championships. She was born in Canada, went to high school in the United Arab Emirates, and has lived in Scotland, France, Switzerland, and the US. Today, her home is Victoria, British Columbia, where she lives with her daughter, Rosalie. Sarah founded Feisty Media in 2017 with the goal of creating an empowering culture for all active women. Feisty Media approaches change-making in a multidisciplinary way using 4 pillars of performance, and those are physiology, nutrition, mental health, and culture. In addition to being the head Feisty Chief, Sarah also hosts the Feisty Women's Performance Podcast and is an amateur CrossFitter. Sarah, welcome to the Real Fit Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Pam. I'm excited to be here.
Same. I always start the show by asking my guests to tell me a bit about your relationship with movement, food, fitness, your body, all that good stuff. Where did it start? Where are you now? I know it's kind of a big question, but just like nutshell.
And like, how long do we have? I was a kid, thankfully, that had parents that encouraged me to play sport. I think I always found like joy in moving my body. I tried every sport as a kid and loved it. I also realized very early on that being a professional athlete was going to be very unlikely because I was a girl. Like that was something that like hit me really hard when I was a kid, realizing that like there just weren't women on professional sports teams on TV. In my teenage years, I also continued to play sport, and we'll talk about it later, but that's when I started to become a little bit awkward with my body and had to figure out like the joy of playing sport and figure out the connection between the physical and mental too side. I figured out when I was, you know, a teenager. And as an adult, I 100% continue to do CrossFit for my mental health.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Mm-hmm. What sports did you play as a kid?
Oh, and so soccer was the main one.
Okay.
I think at one point I was on 3 different soccer teams, and I was even in a traveling league by the time I was 11, playing all over the US. At school, I had basketball, volleyball, track. I used to be upset when 2 sports would overlap each other. I remember I couldn't play badminton and soccer and do track in the same like quarter or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
I also remember like, and I loved and hated this, that like my dad used to put me in every sport all mm-hmm. the time. At one point I did judo. We did baseball. I did like just crazy. And then whatever, I ended up liking soccer and really stuck with that.
As a soccer player, did you discover early on that you were good at running?
I don't think I realized that I was good at running until I was like 25. Like,
You moved right from like feeling awkward to, and now CrossFit for mental health. You skipped over the whole like pro triathlete.
I was trying to be brief.
Yeah. I want to go there. So growing up, you were like, I couldn't be a pro athlete, but then you were. Where did that shift happen?
Yeah, I think the reason I bring that up is that was such an impactful part of my journey, was noticing that I could only watch women playing sport on TV like once every 4 years in the Olympic Games. Mm-hmm. My lived experience was at that time, pre-puberty, that I was one of the most athletic kids in my class, male or female. And then the grown-up world didn't really make sense. It didn't really align. It was kind of a painful observation, which is why mm-hmm. I bring it up, and it's a big part of my journey. I didn't intentionally find my way. I wasn't just like, I want to be a pro athlete. I did tons of other things. I did a PhD along the way. But triathlon was something that I just found. I started doing triathlon. Actually, we moved to the Middle East when I was 14 years old. And they didn't have the same team sports. Like, we lived in this small town outside Dubai. And they didn't have, but there were kids from all over the world there, but there was like maybe one American kid and one kid from Australia. And then there were lots of kids from the Middle East and India and Pakistan and Africa. The level of girls' sport just wasn't the same because it was a small place, because girls and women's sport isn't as big in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. So especially at that time, I started to swim and run by myself.
Mm-hmm. At age 14, you were like, I'm just going to swim and run by myself.
Yeah, because I wanted to continue to exercise. And I just wasn't getting what I wanted out of the team sports. I was still playing team sports. There was no girls' soccer team at all. Okay. I remember going to volleyball tournaments then, basketball. But the level of play wasn't the same, the frequency of practice, all of those things. So I kind of missed that movement piece. Okay. When I say run, like I'd go for a 2K jog.
Okay, so you got out.
I can remember running 5K with my dad. But I didn't really realize that I was good at running until much later when I was doing triathlon, to answer your original question.
Yeah. Did you say you were in Dubai?
Outside Dubai. Outside Dubai. Like an hour inland.
Yeah. Getting to the Middle East and starting to swim and run on your own, was this before or after or like during the point where you started to feel awkward in your body?
Oh, yeah. So I think it was around that time. Yeah, it was around that time because I had very early puberty. And I remember looking back, I recognize what was happening is that I was undereducated. I just was not informed mm-hmm. about what was going to happen. I was maybe 13 years old. And I was also bigger because at early puberty, I was like bigger than the other kids around me.
Yeah.
When I was about 14, 15, I started to connect the dots between food and weight gain, right? Yeah. Because that was like all in the zeitgeist at that time. Like every totally. Women's magazine about health was to do with weight loss.
Totally. Right? So yeah. Very... I mean, the idea of like fat, it's like, I would like to point out there's nothing wrong with being fat, but we didn't right. know that in the 90s. For me, it meant something. And right. I'm still trying to unlearn all the things that I was told that being fat or being thin meant.
Mm-hmm. I like just experienced myself as having changed so dramatically, right? Yeah. And there was very much a negative, there was very, very negative stigma around any excess body fat. And that was it. I decided I was going to sort of start to cut down my calories and try to lose weight, you know?
That's where it started.
And it worked. To some yep. extent, it worked. You know, my brain didn't work sometimes, but
who cares about that?
Right. You don't need that, right?
It's a detail. So, okay. So talk me through, you finish high school, you get to college, like where does triathlon enter your life?
Oh, so let's see. So I was swimming and running on my own. When I went to university in Canada, I joined the swim team and I just eked my way in.
You just walked onto the swim team?
I walked onto the swim team.
Okay.
Which sounds impressive, but actually I got really lucky because sounds impressive, but it's not. I'm going to tell you why.
I'm impressed. I don't think you can stop me from being impressed.
The coach, the way that he recruited the walk-ons was he basically gave us the two hardest weeks of training he could possibly think of. And if you survived, you could join the team. So I just showed up and swam as hard as I could every day for 2 weeks. And then at the end of it, I was on the team.
Okay.
Yeah. So
did you already have good technique when you got to the team?
I don't even know. Honestly, it's so weird. I think about that experience now and I think nobody helped me with my technique. It must not have been good because
good or else how could you have done it?
I wasn't a kid swimmer. Like all the other people on the team had been swimmers as kids, you know, that get up at 5 a.m. and go swimming.
Yeah,
with the
yeah, swim yeah.
Pool. That wasn't me. I swam up at laps of the local hotel pool, right? Not every day and not at 5 a.m. So I don't know why. I don't know why to this day. I don't know why, like, nobody helped me. Nobody.
Yeah.
They just didn't bother coaching me. I wasn't fast enough to make an impact. I was fast enough to be on the team at the tail end, but I wasn't fast enough to make an impact on any awards or medals.
But it gave you a taste of, like, this is swimming. And then from there, how did triathlon
question. I just decided to do a triathlon one summer, 1999. So I would have been about 23. And I did like the local triathlon in Kingston, Ontario, where I was going to university. I didn't do it very well. I just did the triathlon. I had ridden my bike maybe 3 times in my life before it. It was really fun. And then when I went to Scotland to do my PhD, I decided I wanted to join the triathlon club. So I went and found the little university triathlon club. I joined it. And because Scotland's a smaller country, like at that time, Canada was one of the leaders in triathlon. Like the next year we won the gold medal in the men's race and in the first Olympic triathlon, right? In Canada, it was very competitive. Mm-hmm. Scotland, meh.
Yeah.
So I was training in Scotland, and then I eventually went to a race and I did okay. You know, I can't remember I finished near the top. I thought, okay, maybe I can be good at this. And then I started to actually train to try to be better, to see how good I could be.
Okay. And, but still, to go from like, and at this point, are you now pursuing your PhD?
Yes, I was pursuing my PhD.
So pursuing the PhD, and how did you get the opportunity to become a pro? Like, were you at some point like, oh, I'm going to earn my pro card? Or did like a coach approach you and say, you know, we see a lot of potential in you, Sarah? How did it transpire?
Okay, I love how you're digging in here.
Yeah, I don't stop.
These are such fun stories to think about too. What happened was, so first, like, I thought, like, okay, if I can come third in this local race. And then I started winning local races because the whole national team was away at camps in France and Spain and stuff like this. And so, like, that offered opportunities for the rest of us to kind of sneak in on the podium or whatever. Gotcha. First thing I did was hire a coach. And then it's a small country. Like, that coach was connected to the national team. I found out that once you lived in Scotland, at the time, I don't know if this is still true, but if you've lived there for 3 years, you can qualify to be on a national team.
Okay.
So I went and started training, got my coach to get me invited to train with the national team. I remember we did time trials to, like, make the team, right? And there was an A standard and a B standard. And you had to make the A in one and at least the B in the other to get onto the team. And there was no way I was going to make the A for the swimming at that time, especially. I decided I had to double down and run really fast. And to this day, the time trial I did to get on the national team is my fastest 10K ever.
Amazing.
I never got better after that. But I destroyed myself. It's the only time I ran under 35 minutes for 10K on that time trial. But so I sort of wiggled my way in there thinking that was going to be the way to get the best coaching.
Meanwhile, where were you in terms of sports nutrition? And what was your coach even saying? Like, what was being said about sports nutrition? I got into the sport in like the early 2000s. I did my first Ironman in 2007, and I was all over like reading the blogs. Remember, did you have a blog?
Yeah. I had a blog before there were blogs.
Like, I was like reading the blogs. I don't remember anybody saying a word about sports nutrition. I just remember people like casually writing about like, trying to get down to race weight. And it was just like, everyone wants to be at race weight and we want that all year long. Where were you in that conversation and your coaches and your team and all of that?
So interesting. So I had a training partner. Actually, the national team coach introduced me to this woman who was moving over from running. She was one of the best runners in the UK, but she kept getting injured and she was coming over to triathlon. And so they're like, and she also lived near me, and they decided we're going to be training partners. We ended up being best friends. And every day, you know, when you ride your bike with someone every single day, you run with someone every day, you become really close. She was a nutritionist, a dietitian. She helped me. Like, we did the whole thing. We did the food journaling. That's the first time I learned, for example, that you need to take in carbohydrate to recover. Yeah. Like I didn't know any of that. I had just been riding a energy roller coaster prior to that. If you do a hard workout and then wait until you feel hungry again to actually eat, like it's just a constant cycle of like crashing and then eating a ton of food.
Yeah.
And then working out again. She got me off that roller coaster and got me to start having carbs during. I actually eat during. I used to go on 2-3 hour bike rides and not eat anything and wonder why I felt like crap. She really got me onto like those basic things of like mm-hmm. sports drinks, eating after. The funny thing about that time, and this has to do with, you know, the early 2000s again, like the sports nutrition advice was just carbs, 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 carbs yes. all the time and low fat.
Snackwell cookies. Remember those?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Fat-free everything.
Exactly. So I did start to have some problems with my blood sugar.
Yeah.
And then once, you know, once some of the other information started to come through about like, I forget what they used to call it, the GI level of the food, how fast the food absorbs. What mm-hmm. was that called? That was a whole phase.
The glycemic index.
Index. Yes. That's what it is. When we started to figure out, okay, you do need later, you need protein to recover. Mm-hmm. You need like more complex carbohydrates. Then I started to add in those kinds of things, like have the fast absorbing carbs during and after training. And then later have a more complete meal. Prior to that, I had just been overemphasizing the carbs way too much. And then once I got to there, it got better.
Okay. And now like this whole time, so you became a pro, what was it? Is 2003 correct?
Yeah, 2003, I did my first pro race.
But you did not win your first Ironman until 2014. Is that right?
Yeah.
That's amazing. Were you 38 when you won your first Ironman?
38, yeah.
Amazing. Was that Ironman Brazil?
Yeah.
Okay. And then was it Ironman Canada after that, the same year?
Yeah, it was Mont Tremblant.
Okay. I'm not going to say that word. I'm just.
I know. I can't say it. People make fun of me, but I can't say Mont Tremblant. Like, I don't. Mont Tremblant. I have to.
Talk to me about what changed during that journey. Number one, did you always have this vision of someday I'm going to win an Ironman? Like, did you believe in yourself that whole time?
I think the puzzle piece that makes this make sense is that I had my first pro race in 2003 in Nice, the old Nice race. So it was one race. I went to my first Ironman in 2004, went to Ironman Switzerland, Ironman Canada, and I came fourth in both of them. So I was fourth in my first Ironman ever. And then the next year I won a European long course championships and I came sixth in the ITU long course worlds. And this is a typical, even my coach at the time told me this and I can see it. It's a typical career path where you have this early success, right? Because if you start training hard and dedicating yourself to something and focus on it, you're going to get to like 80 or 90% of how good you're going to be very quickly.
Totally.
And at that 80 or 90%, it should be something that gets you some kind of accolades if you have a future in it, right? So it's like that early success. And then typically it's like the, you know, the hero's journey, the gates of hell open. And you have to go through all of this stuff to get to the next level. It's like a giant video game. I really think this is such a common journey, right? But it's because like that last 10% is so hard to fight for, even if the journey is smooth. Right. Okay. And that's what I needed to get from like a podium in an Ironman to first place in an Ironman. So I had proof of like, I can do this. I think I can do this. But it just didn't happen. And like year after year after year after year, it just didn't happen until I was 38.
That's awesome. So, and talk to me about how your nutrition changed. I know you said you got it dialed in with your buddy, but also I read on the Feisty Media website where I think on the page about fuel, was the course called Fuel or Fueled? I can't recall.
Fueled, yeah.
Fueled, which I just took. I have a few modules to complete, but it is so good. Cool. I know Sarah's going to talk about this later, but like keep it in mind. This Feisty Media course Fueled is phenomenal. But on the Fueled page, you shared your story about literally falling on your face at the end of an Ironman where you were poised to come in, what, top three or even number two?
I was running in third.
Yeah.
It was such a strange experience because I didn't have any sensation of falling. I only saw the pavement moving towards my face. It's so weird. And then I don't remember anything for a while. And then I was standing up and walking. And on the video, I was running and I had just overtaken fourth place. I was running in third. The camera was on me. So we have the video footage of it. I've seen it. I don't know where it is, but it's before everything was on the internet, thankfully. And I can see myself in the video, like stumbling around, like Mm-hmm. But I don't remember any of it.
On the website, you attributed that to this pursuit of starvation. Mm-hmm. To try to be in a smaller body. Talk to us about that. What was that like? And was it immediately like at the finish line that you were like, the starvation thing isn't working for me? Or did it take a minute for that to settle?
Oh, no. I don't think I realized until years later why that happened. And when I started to understand what red S and LEA are.
Yeah.
Low energy availability. I was 100% in a state of low energy availability.
And tell us how you got there. Like, what did that look like for you?
So at the time, I think often we associate these like red S, which is relative energy deficiency in sport, and LEA, low energy availability. We often associate it with eating disorders. And like you said earlier, starvation, which isn't untrue. But then we put it down to the mental health of the athlete.
Yeah.
Sometimes. And from what I've seen, with what I've learned and the people I've talked to over the last couple of years, since we made the course, the Fueled course, and since we're learning so much more about these things, is that absolutely that's not necessarily true. You can end up unintentionally in a state of low energy availability. And there was a whole time period there in which we were told that in order to run fast, you needed to be smaller.
Yeah.
Athletes were told it was an indication of performance.
Yeah. More right? So you and think for runners than cyclists?
That's hard to say. I think potentially that for cyclists as well. I think every sport, honestly, gymnastics, I've heard swimmers say this. This goes across sports, that we somehow attribute this, what your body looks like and fitness are kind of seen as parallel.
Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah. How many times have you run into somebody and they say, oh, you look fit?
Yeah.
I'm like, that doesn't even, yeah, it's toxic.
You're like, I'm just dehydrated. Like, it's very toxic. And I think that we overemphasize that over the health of the athlete.
Yeah.
And that's where the problem came in, is that like somehow it was, I was told to go to bed hungry by a coach, so that I could be leaner, so that I would race faster. We actually believed that. My entire career, I was with national team groups of people, all of whom, male and female, were all constantly trying to lose weight on these national team training camps, where sometimes we were at altitude. Yeah. We're training 30 hours a week. This is, now we know that you absolutely have to focus on your health during that time.
Yeah.
That often getting enough fuel in is difficult.
Yeah.
Without being healthy, you're not going to lose weight anyway. There is a small iota of truth in that if you're lighter, it takes less energy to move. It's like physics. The weight of something takes less energy to move across. Like, it's gravity, right?
Yeah.
But that's just like one aspect of, if you have performance, like all the things that create a performance, it's one out of 50 pieces.
Yes.
And somehow we ended up focusing on that one piece so much and not on the other things as much as we should have. That's where it went wrong. I started to go to bed hungry, and I was just after athletic performance.
Yeah.
Like, I was not, like, this is the difference between, I was definitely, I look at the pictures of myself then and I'm like, who would tell that young woman to lose weight? That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. So I wasn't like worried about aesthetics.
Yeah.
I just wanted performance. So when experts told me, this is how you lean down and go to bed hungry or whatever else. And I remember at that particular training block, and the reason it happened in that race that I collapsed was because in that training block, I doubled down on that. Like, I don't mind. I'll go to bed hungry. I'll do whatever. I want to win the race.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did. And I went to bed hungry every single day, probably for a solid 3 months. Yeah. And
that sounds miserable. Okay. I trained for Ironmans, and not to win, not to be a pro, but I remember waking up in the middle of the night hungry. I guess it's 3 a.m., but it's time to eat cereal because I'm hungry. Like, I can't imagine functioning hungry like that for a period of time sustained.
Yeah.
My sense is, from what you're telling me, especially that you had wanted this goal for so long, and now you're at the point in your career where the small things make a difference. For normal people, probably the best thing you could do is get a good night of sleep, recover well, don't do too much too quickly. But for you, you were looking for that little edge. Would that be fair to say that you were like, that's where my edge is going to be, losing this weight?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And when you do the math on even a couple pounds, how much faster you run over a marathon, seems like it's worth it, right?
If you're not taking into account the fact that, like you said, there's 50 things that say that go into performance. Now that you're like you know, you're doing the Fueled course, you run all these excellent podcasts. What's your sense of why there has been so much focus on this one out of, say, just throwing that number out there, 50 elements of performance?
Yeah, that's really difficult to answer. I think that we have this longstanding sort of cultural norm around, especially for women, around like thinness being ideal. And that gets pulled over into sport as well. The other thing is that women are a late addition to sport. Yeah. Like, we came from being not even allowed in the stadium in the original ancient Olympic Games, right? I heard a story yesterday about during one of the, was it World War II in the UK, the women started playing soccer just in recreational leagues, and people from the towns would come out and watch them. A lot of the men were away. It became so popular that they banned women from playing soccer because they were worried that it was going to distract people from watching the men's game when they came back. So we've been like banned from things. We were in 1964, we were banned from running anything more than,
you know, 800 meters.
800 meters.
I was just reading about that. I was reading about how they were reporting that women were falling down at the finish line and like practically needed to be resuscitated. But then when you watch the video, which we were on a road trip, so I had time. I'm like, I'm going down this rabbit
hole. Did you watch the video?
Yeah, I did. I wonder if it was from something Feisty posted. I don't know how I approached that rabbit hole, but I was like, nobody's dying at this finish line. If anything, it looks like they could have ran harder.
Yeah, 11 wretched women. We're way down a rabbit hole. And I'm going to come back to the reason why we focus so much on losing weight.
Yeah.
But there was a reporter for like the New York, whatever like the New York Times was back then, who wrote this article that said that there were women collapsing all over. And they weren't. Like,
no,
I went and found the video like you did. And when you watch it, there's one woman who kind of stumbles a little and then an official helps her up at the end. Yep. There weren't even 11. There were 9 women who ran on the track. Like, how he got the story, I don't know.
I think it was like the original fake news.
Yeah, totally. It's just like, you're so set on what you think you're going to see that you actually think you saw it. And that women could not handle running.
Yeah, it's like a classic case of confirmation bias. And weren't they saying like women are going to risk their uteruses falling out if they run too hard?
The uteruses falling out was a real argument for like a very, very long time. And it wasn't until I did a podcast with Dr. Alex Coates, who does exercise physiology, and she knew all the history on. She was right on point with it. But, you know, where was it until very recently where there were women who went, wait a second, until women actually started to become physiologists themselves.
Yeah.
And go, oh, wait, like I've never seen a uterus fall out. Maybe that's not real. Like maybe we should do some research here, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Did you have Christine Yu on the podcast?
I did.
Did you guys talk about the thing that she uncovered in her book Up to Speed, where she talked about if you're even at like a 300 calorie deficit for even a period of, I think, only maybe 2 to 3 hours in the day, even if you've gotten your calorie needs met generally through the day, if there's a low period where you're in a deficit for a few hours, that can set you up for LEA. To your point before, it's like, this doesn't necessarily mean you have an eating disorder. Like, you don't have to be emaciated looking to have LEA or ultimately what may lead to red S. And like you described, not being hungry after a workout and deciding, oh, I can wait to eat. Well, no, you really can't. Like, you can, but it has consequences.
Yeah. And one of the things we found when we were doing the research for Fueled is also that like folks in bigger bodies who are in a state of LEA, they're just not believed.
Yes.
You know, like the medical professionals are just like, that's not possible.
Right? No, I know.
Of course it is.
I had a woman on my podcast in a bigger body who was quite athletic and being praised left and right for losing weight. And because she still didn't look particularly, you know, what we think of as thin, she went to the hospital with like symptoms of an eating disorder, but was nobody even asked her about her food intake. They just were like, oh, this is like a random one-off fainting spell. You're fine. Bye. Looking back, she's like, I was undernourished, but no one asked me a darn question about it.
Yeah. So to go back to your original question about how, about why we end up with this focusing on weight so much is that like the fact that women naturally carry a little bit more body fat than men is, and the fact that the male ideal is what is set up as like the norm in sports. That's why I went down the road of all the ways that we've been excluded, because we're only starting to include women's physiology into the research. So we don't really know a ton, although we do know, I don't want to sound like we don't know a ton. We do know a lot, but that's why compared to the male athlete, we tend to hold a little bit more body fat. And so it's this weird thing that everybody internalized that athletes look like a certain way. that's not necessarily how female athletes look. And I think as time goes on, we're even seeing things change. If you think of the way the bodies have changed in gymnastics, for example, 20 years ago, a gymnast was always just tiny, tiny. Now you see these strong, sort of powerful, muscular women doing gymnastics and excelling at the highest level, or diving. You see the body types, tennis, you see the body types evolving as we're moving away from that kind of more male ideal of thinness and striated muscles and whatever else.
Yeah. Do you think we're also seeing more durable athletes as we're starting to see bodies change?
I would think so.
I hope so. Right? Speaking of like trying to fit women into this box of like, okay, the standard quote unquote athlete is a man, so we're supposed to look like him. I loved what you shared with, I think it was Claire and Joy, or Joey and Claire. Am I getting their names wrong? The podcast where you shared about like how we're supposed to just sort of shove our cycles under the rug and be like, whatever, we're going to train around them, train through them, not care about them. And that you had this sort of emotional revelation when you tuned into the feelings that were popping up for you around your cycle. Can you talk about that? Because I found that fascinating.
I'm someone who my mood runs fairly high. One of my friends actually, because you're talking about how I ended up leaving my marriage because of my, so that's just how I ended up leaving.
Not because of your period, but your period's like a truth teller, it sounds like.
My period's a truth teller. One of my friends said to me in relation to me and my ex, your natural mood is like a 7 or an 8 and his is like a 4 or 5. Like you have a mood mismatch. that's an aside. But what would generally happen is that I was going through life, like generally happy. And I was finding that like, once a month or so, and I wouldn't feel as good. I'd start to realize in those moments, oh, wait, my marriage isn't everything that I want it to be. And it was only, it was almost because that PMS phase kind of brought my mood a little bit lower that I was able to see things through a different lens. So I was kind of ignoring some problems that I knew that I wasn't going to be able to live with. For the rest of my life, or that it wasn't really what I wanted out of a partnership, and that I should be asking for better for myself. And so I was always kind of grateful for those low moods that kind of felt like they brought me down to earth a little bit.
Yeah.
And thought, oh, actually, like I could have a better partnership. And just because I'm happy in life in general doesn't mean that I need to put up with something that's just mediocre.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you see parallels between what you're describing and renegotiating your relationship with food as you were like paying more attention and going, if I eat right after a workout, I actually feel better. Like if I pay attention to this low energy state of like, oh, these workouts feel like a drag, I can't recover. The pavement is like, would you say there was some level of tuning into the nutrition piece that paying attention in a similar way helped you move through that, or if I'm making too big of a leap, just tell me.
I'm not sure if it's too big of a leap, but yes, I do think paying attention and being mindful is everything.
Yeah.
Right. So I think with the nutrition piece, with Fueled, a lot of the people on the course and the feedback that we got, because we had a section around intuitive eating, and a lot of people like, I don't know how to do that. I can't trust my body's cues. And then also, if you're an athlete or you exercise regularly, you tend to have this time period after you exercise where your appetite's dampened. And the experts yet will tell you that's when you need to eat.
Yes, that's confusing.
Yeah, it is confusing. And so I think there were some people who were like, I don't know if I can do this. They didn't trust themselves around eating. And I think having done that so often, like eaten, I feel like there's another level after that, which is okay. I forced myself to have my recovery shake, even though I didn't feel like it. And then what do I feel like for the rest of the day?
Yeah.
It's not just like the mindfulness in the moment of I don't feel like eating now and I'm not going to. That's almost like overly simplistic, but it's this layered approach of, but if I listen to the experts and eat now, are there changes down the road? And the change for me, if I have a proper recovery shake, now I do CrossFit, after CrossFit, is that I likely won't get an afternoon slump where I'm not as productive or whatever else I'm trying to do at that time.
Yes.
So that's the difference. So it is still intuitive.
Right. Because the way I describe it to people is like, it's not just what do I want right now? Because sometimes you got to eat that shake, even if you don't want it right now. But it's also going based on experience, what do I think will make me feel best going forward? Just like I might know eating a bag of cookies might feel really good right now because I'm feeling depressed or sad or bored or putting off whatever project. But I also know like in an hour after I've eaten a bag of cookies, that's going to feel disgusting. So like flip it around. Like I'm going to feel good if I eat this food now. And it's like, it's about the whole day. I hope you don't mind me asking, are you perimenopausal now?
I am. Yeah. And it started just over a year ago.
How's that going?
Mm-hmm. So at first it was kind of shocking. At least I knew what it was.
Yeah.
I had symptoms that if I wasn't used to exercising regularly, I wouldn't have even recognized them. Mm-hmm. The one of the main things that happened was I wouldn't consistently show up for my workouts and I couldn't trust my body to do what it normally does.
When you say you didn't show up, do you mean you physically would not go to the gym?
No, sorry, my body wouldn't show up for me. So I'm like trying and I can't. I couldn't go hard and I couldn't and I felt, it's hard to explain, but if anyone has those couple flat days right before your period, like mm-hmm. I used to get that, I'd be physically a little bit flat and exercising doesn't feel great. Sometimes I would have that for 2 weeks.
Just every single day, day in and day out, day, no reprieve.
Yeah. And that affected my mood because I wasn't getting the endorphins and I was used to exercising. So there was a bit of a downward spiral. And the other thing that started happening was I started having the kind of perimenopausal like brain farts, like you, where your mind goes blank mm-hmm. on words and stuff like that. And that started all of a sudden for me as well. One of the solutions actually was Celine Yeager, who hosts our Hit Play Not Pause podcast. I was talking to her about it and she said, try creatine. I'm not really a supplement person, but I started taking a creatine supplement and that helped actually being able to exercise a little bit harder again, mm-hmm. which increased my mood. And mm-hmm. it also helps with the brain function stuff and perimenopause.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Going back to like how you said, okay, at least now you knew what questions to ask. You knew, okay, this might be perimenopause versus 11 or 12 year old Sarah. That's like, what's happening? I guess I'm just gaining weight. Why? I don't know. How is this informing the conversations that you have with your daughter?
Yeah, great question. My daughter is 12 and she's like fully through puberty. Like she looks like she's 16 years old. I will not have a conversation with her about her body or about sex unless she wants to. Mm-hmm. Sometimes she'll bring up something and then I'll let her kind of lead and I'll let her, but I definitely shield her from any kind of, I know she gets it from other places, but like any of that kind of messaging that she's, again, it's that negative thing around too big. I know that she gets some negative messaging from other places too, because her body changed so quickly. I just continue to tell her like how amazing she looks. The main message about exercise, I've stuck to this for years and years and years, is around mental health and feeling good. And like, that is why I tell her, like, that's why I exercise every day. This is why I think everyone should exercise. I think it's really important because you will feel better. So I just try to keep the message like that and let her lead.
How has it been for you going from a career as a pro athlete? And I mean, an athlete that's competing in 3 sports, training like full-time job to like just regular person doing your hour of CrossFit a day. I don't know if you had the sensation as a pro of feeling really good because you check all the boxes and your training peaks or whatever looks like, oh, look at all these hours, look at all these miles and yards and TSS scores. And it feels good, right? And then like some part of that, like at least for me, that sort of seeped into my sense of self-worth. Like I felt really good if I nailed all my workouts. And if I didn't, it wasn't just, oh, life came up. Sometimes it was, I'm lazy or I suck or something like that. How do you negotiate good self-worth and not letting it hinge on your performance?
Yeah. So there's 2 parts to that answer, right? The first part is I took all of that part of me that is goal-oriented and I put it into building my business. It's like all the training peaks boxes to check. I'm checking them in a different place in terms of like I'm making a to-do list, for example, and checking it off. That took care of that part of me, the part of me that needed like a big project to work on, something that's very goal-oriented that I could really sink my teeth into and like put my whole self into. That's my business. And then on the other side, I realized I needed to exercise in order to maintain not just my mental health, but also mood.
Yes.
And I fight really hard for my moods because I know that I'm going to enjoy life more if I'm in a better mood. I'm going to make better decisions for my businesses if I'm feeling positive. I'm going to be better with my employees if I'm positive. You're just going to be projecting better into the world. If you love yourself, you love other people, you love what you're doing. It all works together. And so I fight for that really hard.
Yeah.
And when I first started my business, I decided I'm going to figure out how little energy I can do to spend as little time as possible doing it so I could have maximum time for my business. Mm-hmm. And so I went down to just only running. And I was running once a day between 30 minutes and an hour, maybe a little over an hour. And I could get by on that. But then I realized, oh, but I don't think I'm quite nailing. I don't think I'm quite nailing it. Like, I think physically I need a little bit more. I need a little bit more strength work and stuff like that. But that really wasn't the reason. I need something else. But that's when I decided to try CrossFit and see if I could. And actually going a little bit harder, doing more strength work, all of that helped even more than just running. So for me, it was more about like finding a minimum of things, like finding something that I love that I can do in a small amount of time.
Yep.
That's going to allow me to do the other things that I want to do in life, which is build a business.
Yes. I love that. Do you still occasionally go on a long bike ride or jump into a triathlon for fun?
Not on a long bike ride.
Okay.
If someone invited me on a long bike ride, no, I wouldn't. I still wouldn't.
You wouldn't. Is biking like just never your favorite?
I like bike. It takes too much time.
Yeah, it does.
Like I'd be hard pressed to find like a 3-hour chunk where I'd be like, yeah, I'm going to go biking now. Okay. That's just not how my schedule works right now. I did last summer out of nowhere. I did a triathlon relay.
Yeah.
An Olympic distance. It's like you have the muscle memory, right? Am I either going to kill myself and end up injured, or I'm just going to go slow? It was fine. I still knew how to go all out for 1500 meters, but that's just fun.
Okay. All right. And then in terms of CrossFit, do you look at the workout before you show up, or you just show up blind?
I just show up blind.
Okay.
I'm that person. I've become increasingly over the years fine with the unknown.
Okay. But what if it's rope climbs? Don't you wish you had your little sleeve?
Oh, then I just borrow a sleeve from.
Okay.
Yeah. Occasionally I've ended up with the wrong shorts on. If you've clearly done CrossFit before.
Yeah. And now that we're talking about it, I miss it. I haven't done it in a while.
Yeah. If you end up, if there's like handstand pushups or something and you have the wrong shorts on.
Oh, yeah.
You know, one of the ass in the air with the wrong shorts. So that's happened to me a couple times, but it's worth the risk to not have to think about it or do any pre-planning.
What's your favorite thing, or what are you best at?
Oh, man. Okay. I love all the things.
All the things?
Yeah.
Like, do you love a wall ball as much as you love, say, like a muscle up?
No, I can't do a muscle up. So there's that. It's funny. Yeah. Who likes wall balls? Nobody likes wall balls.
I love to hate them.
Exactly. That's the relationship with it. And I find like if I'm a little bit tired, there are some things like something like a wall ball will be like, oh, I don't want to do that right now. I love the variety. That's why I go to CrossFit.
Yeah, for sure. I miss that. And the friends, I like the people.
Absolutely. And the other thing about showing up blind, and I think this is totally undervalued. Like, I think we've overvalue organization and preparation, and we undervalue teaching ourselves to think on our feet, trusting ourselves and being confident. I think you need all of those things. Develop all of those skills. Yes, don't be the person who's not prepared all of the time, right? But also don't be the person who has to be prepared all of the time. Because then if you end up in a situation where you have to think on your feet, you're not going to be able to do it.
I love that. To what extent do you feel like having a background as an endurance athlete helps you as a CrossFitter?
As a CrossFitter.
Ways. Yeah.
Interesting.
Whether mentally or physically, like both.
So I just did a CrossFit competition, like a little local one this past weekend. And we did the last workout, which was just yesterday morning, was a ton of lunges, weighted lunges, and then shuttle runs.
Okay.
I'm like, oh, I'm actually prepared for this. I'm prepared for burning quads and running after. physically prepared. Also, I think as soon as the workouts get above, like sometimes I don't know how people go out as hard as they do. Mm-hmm. When I'm watching people do workouts and we're doing them together, they can go out just guns blazing and I can't. But then once the workouts get longer, like over 10 minutes, I tend to reel a few people back in.
Yeah. I feel like that's funny because your perspective changes so much when you're only there for an hour. It's like, yeah, anything over 15 minutes starts to feel like an endurance event as far as CrossFit is concerned.
Yeah.
Another question regarding how your endurance background has informed things going forward. What specific lessons have you taken from your pro career into Feisty Media?
Lots. I think athletes and entrepreneurs have a lot in common. Successful athletes and successful entrepreneurs. You only lose when you stop. Your business only fails when you stop doing it, when you stop looking for a solution. And it's the same with sport. If I'd stopped, I wouldn't have won Ironman.
Yeah.
I think in endurance sport in particular, like you learn to just ride the wave, right? It's good and then it's bad and you feel terrible and you feel great and whatever else happens. And you go through the journey, you get a flat, you change it. you know what
yep.
I mean? Like
yep.
I think about even, oh, I probably can't talk about that. but like
dying to know.
No, okay, I can talk about this. In Canada, when we reported our income, I'm just describing a challenge that I had this last week, okay. Right? It's equivalent. This is what happened to you is equivalent of like the, is it the IRS? Like, is that the?
Yeah, we have the IRS in the US.
You have the IRS in the US.
The Internal Revenue Service. They want your tax returns.
Yeah, so that's the right agency. So I am in Bentonville at our gravel festival. The whole team's there. I get a call. Usually I don't even answer calls I don't know because there's probably spam.
Sure.
Call it. Anyway, it's like the Canadian equivalent of the IRS calling. We're auditing this aspect of your, right? Like you, and it's like, oh gosh, just things like that seem to happen all the time. And then you're like, okay, now I have to go back. Thank God my accountant's good. Books are in order. We can send off the stuff. But like, it's just what that's like a flat tire.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like a bump in the road. It's like a injury or a flat tire. Or like you lose your bottle or like you were talking about like the hero's journey. It's just like another thing. Can you survive this challenge and move on?
Yeah. And the quicker you can get back on track, the better. If you waste time going, oh my gosh, I got a flat tire. The IRS called. It's the worst thing that ever happened. If you waste energy on that, you just wasted all that time. Instead, just I'll change the tire. Yeah. I bitched for a minute to one of my colleagues. I was like, great, this sucks. And then call up the person who's going to find everything that we need to change the flat tire, as it were.
Yeah, I love that. And the final question I like to ask people as we kind of wind down is, where do you find the balance between the tension I think so many of us feel between, like you were talking about earlier, like if you love yourself, you're just going to do better. Everything's going to feel better. We want to love ourselves. We want to give ourselves compassion. We don't want to beat ourselves up when things go wrong. How do you balance the self-compassion and the self-love with this drive to be better? Whether it's, I mean, I don't know if you care about getting a muscle up, but obviously you're trying to grow Feisty Media. Where's that balance for you?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think we often make the mistake of thinking that like beating ourselves up is somehow part of the learning. You can apply self-compassion immediately and still take the lessons, right? Like you don't have to, or if something's going to feel bad, it feels bad anyway. You can't get rid of an emotion or shove it down. At least you shouldn't, right?
You can try. So, I think it will come back for you at some point.
Exactly. It's not really a healthy way. So like processing emotions, yes, whatever, but mentally beating yourself up, which to me would be the opposite of self-compassion, right?
Yeah.
Is not a worthwhile endeavor. And it does not help. And I think it's almost an excuse. Like people set themselves up, you almost martyr yourself, right? For like telling yourself all the reasons that you can't do it. So then when you fail, you're like, I knew I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas it's scary to apply self-compassion. I think that's why we don't. We're scared to think I can do it. I could do it. Because what if we don't? What if we're wrong?
Right. Or sometimes what if we do? Like that's scary too. Success can be almost as scary, if not more so than failure.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Which is weird to say, but it's something I'm, I don't know, it's something I've known, but something I'm like knowing on a deeper level lately. So thank you. I love that everyone has their own answer to that question. And it's so enlightening. And it's a question I'm kind of obsessed with, which is why I always ask it. So I love it. Thank you. Where can people find you and learn more about Feisty Media and all of the many podcasts that you have? What do you have? At least six?
We've got 7 active ones.
Okay.
And then we have probably 3 or 4 others that have been shorter series.
Cool. Yeah. So tell us where we can find you and learn more about you and what you're doing.
So our main Instagram account is Feisty_media. Mm-hmm. And that's the one like where we're covering lots of different women's sports and things that happen in women's sports broadly. From there, you can also find all of our other Instagram accounts.
Okay.
Like the menopause account, Women's Performance, which is my podcast, Girls Got Gravel, the Gravel Cycling one, and Feisty Triathlon. They'll all be linked there. Our website is livefeisty.com.
Okay.
And it's Feisty EI. I always say like I before E, except if you're feisty. It's spelled EI.
Well, stay feisty. Thank you so much for coming on. I loved our conversation.
Thanks, Pam.
Thank you so much for listening. I appreciate you sticking with me till the end. If you liked what you heard, it would mean so much to me if you haven't already, if you would rate this podcast, give it a nice review, follow it, subscribe. And if you listen on Spotify, or even if you don't, you can now rate podcasts on Spotify, which is a relatively new thing. If you've done all those things already, I'm sending you a huge virtual hug. You can also support the show by telling a friend, text them a link to the episode, or post it on social media. And don't forget to tag me. My Instagram handle is at PamMoore303. And on Twitter, I am at PamMooreWriter. A shout out means so much to me. Additionally, if you are feeling like you are ready to change your relationship with food and your body and exercise, and you want to make space for the things in your life that really, really matter, I can help you. I am an occupational therapist with a certification as an intuitive eating coach, and it would be my pleasure to help you clear away all the mental clutter that comes with trying to manipulate the shape and size of your body. So you can get all the information you need on that on my website, pam-moore.com. Again, that's pam-moore.com. And if you would like my free guide, it's called 11 Things You Can Do Right Now to Feel Better About Your Body. You can get that on my website too. When you sign up for my newsletter at pam-moore.com, you're going to get that free gift. And the newsletter comes, it's only every other week, and it's always a juicy tidbit, something pertaining to self-love, self-compassion, self-acceptance, intuitive eating, all that good stuff, and some links to the best things I've found, usually pertaining to those topics. Occasionally there's an outlier, but it's all good stuff, and I try to keep it super short, and that lands in inboxes every other Tuesday. Again, thank you so much for being here. Till next time, keep it real.